You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's often said that the most important work of art in the Guggenheim Museum's collection is the Frank Lloyd Wright building itself. To mark its 50th anniversary this year, the museum has just mounted an exhibit that's something of an overview of the architect's career called Frank Lloyd Wright, From Within Outward. Its co-curators join me now, Thomas Krenz, the former director of the Guggenheim. He is now senior advisor of international affairs for the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation. And David van der Leer, who is the museum's assistant curator of architecture and design. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be here.
Tom, did you begin planning the show while you were still director of the museum?
Yes. I mean, the exhibitions take time to develop and gestate, so to speak. I mean, we began thinking about the Frank Lloyd Wright show probably about 10 years ago for the first time. And I mean, it's an obvious reason. As you said, the building is, we knew it was approaching its 50th anniversary. It is the greatest object probably in the collection. In fact, it was accessioned by the Board of Directors as a work of art inside the collection. So you begin thinking about this over a period of time, and I think the real issue is whether you can get the material if the timing is right, if the presentation is right. And it became a serious project about 4 years ago.
Well, you have a number of exhibits of the work of architects that you've done
That's
over
right.
the years.
That's right.
But this is the first one of Frank Lloyd Wright's. it's kind of surprising.
In part, you have to pace exhibitions. There was a Wright retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in 1985, which was a little bit before I came to the Guggenheim. So there tends to be something like a 20-year gap between episodes, so to speak.
And how different is this?
Well, I think it's fundamentally different. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that you can re-examine material every two decades or so. We do that with artists, with Roy Lichtenstein, with Bob Rauschenberg. There's a different take on it. There's different work. Different work comes to light. And in this particular case, I think the focus was the linchpin was developing a working relationship with Taliesin, because Taliesin had the material. 22,000 drawings by Wright, 600 drawings from just of the Guggenheim. And when there was a new president of the foundation about 3 years ago, Phil Alsop, we met in New York. I went out to see him in Scottsdale, and we talked about combining our forces and energies. And you really needed the cooperation of Taliesin, because if we really wanted this to be an exhibition that was unique, the material had – there were classic material that had been seen before, some of it, but a lot of it was fresh for a New York audience. And it had to be spectacular. So that, in effect, meant that Taliesin really had to open up the vault, so to speak. And we worked very closely with Bruce Brooks Pfeiffer, who worked with Frank Lloyd Wright back in the 1940s and who was the archivist of the collection.
And David, didn't you join the museum staff to work on the show?
Right. I only joined, almost 8 months ago. So, yeah, it has been a very fast ride over the last months.
And is this because you already know a lot about Frank Lloyd Wright?
No, I'm not a Wright expert. I'm coming from architecture. I worked with Stephen Hall here in the city and OMA in Holland, Rem Koolhaas' office. And I think we had enough expertise on the right side for the project, and yeah, we just needed somebody to work on the show on our end.
There are more than 200 of Wright's original drawings in the show, and they're all quite beautiful. Are they all by his hand?
No, how it works with Wright's drawings is it's often Wright didn't put a pencil on paper until he really had an idea of like what he was going to do.
So this is the opposite of somebody like Frank Gehry, who seems to crumple up a piece of paper and then hand it off to somebody and say, "Okay, this is going to be a building."
Well, he would talk to his apprentices, and then they would start making the drawings. And often he would complete the drawings, so he would do the landscaping in the actual drawings. But it was mainly his apprentices making the drawings, of course. But you see the, his hand in it when you see the landscapes. And there's only just a few sketches in the show. And yeah, those are of course always Wright sketches.
And are all of these from Taliesin?
All of the drawings, almost all of the drawings are coming from the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation indeed in Arizona. And there's, I think, 12 loans.
There are also a number of architectural models in the show, some of them for projects that were never built. Were they made by Wright or were they commissioned for the exhibit?
No, we have three historical models in the show that are really from Wright's time, basically all in a gallery with residential projects. Then we have one model that was made 12 years ago for a show in at the Vitra Museum in Germany. And what we did is we made quite a few new models. There's 12. And it's very important to do because the problem with architectural drawings is that they're beautiful objects to a lot of people, but they cannot understand the spaces that it represents.
And is it easy to take an architectural drawing of this sort and then build a model from it?
No, it's actually quite a process. We worked with two model builders here in the city, CT Studio in Brooklyn and Michael Kennedy here in New York. For the last 6 months.
And because you don't have measurements or anything. You're kind of guessing, aren't you?
In some cases, you have working drawings. It was for all projects that were, almost all projects were not completed. There's only a few buildings that were completed, and that was easier, of course, to make the models of. But in general, it's a really, a painstaking process, but a lot of fun. I think we all learned a lot from it.
My guests are David Van der Leer, who is co-curator of a new exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum called Frank Lloyd Wright, From Within Outward, with Thomas Krenz, the former director of the Guggenheim. And Tom, the title of the show is From Within Outward. What does that mean? Is that another way of saying form follows function?
Well, the title was a struggle. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright had a heroic career in some ways, and I think we really wanted to focus on the ideas behind the work and not just on the drawings as aesthetic objects or the manifestation of certain buildings as architectural monuments, but to show the full scope of Wright's interests in social issues, in public housing, in concepts of design, in urban planning, his views about the city. So, I mean, I'm not sure, David, how many titles were there at a various stage.
Is this something that Wright actually said at one point or wrote down?
Yeah, it is actually. He used it throughout his career very often. And what he's doing is he's trying to explain how it works when he's building his architecture. It's not about necessarily creating an iconic shape on the outside, even though you might get a different feeling with a Guggenheim. But it's always about crafting a space inside, and then the exterior form follows. And for Wright, it wasn't not form follows function, but form and function are always one.
Does this come out of the things that he learned when he was apprenticed to Louis Sullivan?
Yes, of course. That's where form follows function comes from.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the other architectural influences on Wright? Do we know?
Well, I think the main influence for Wright was nature itself and not so much architects around him. And you really see that clearly in most of the projects that we're showing in the exhibition. There's always a relation between the in and the outside, and he's always trying to generate a flow between those two spaces.
And words like organic and natural often come to mind when we look at these works.
It's right.
Early works are of a different sort. They're more rectangular. And then we see these later ones. They all look like they're plant forms or some other kind of a natural outgrowth.
Well, it takes a few decades, of course, to develop a language. But I think throughout his career, there was always this one key aspect that Wright was looking for: flowing spaces inside his buildings. And even in buildings as the Unity Temple, the Larkin Building, that was already very obvious. And of course, in the Guggenheim, it becomes a more organic shape. But it's still a similar way of structuring the building.
Was he thinking in terms of creating a uniquely American style of architecture? Do you know?
I think he was. That's why we focus on both the American home and the American city in two of our galleries. He was definitely looking for something that was completely different from what his European colleagues were doing at the time.
On the other hand, he is still very proud of his Welsh heritage because Taliesin is the name of an ancient Welsh poet, isn't it?
No, Taliesin means shining brow.
Oh,
and
Paul Goldberger got that wrong. It was in the current issue of the New Yorker.
No, it's The Taliesin is built on the brow of a hill, so that's what it's referring to.
He produced over 1,000 designs over the 72 years of his career. How many of them were actually built, and how many remain standing, do we know?
I'm not sure how many are still standing, but Wright had a very good track record of built projects. It's almost 1,100 projects that he designed, and it's almost 500 projects that were built, and it's quite a substantial number, of course.
Wow. Because one thing this exhibition makes clear is that some of his most ambitious and innovative designs were never realized. And you used to work for Rem Koolhaas. I've seen any number of exhibits of his fanciful drawings. I'm not even sure that he intended for some of those buildings to be built.
Well, I think as an architect, you always want your projects to be built, even if they're sometimes very theoretical projects. But it's inherent to the field of architecture that it's not not always getting anywhere.
My guests are Thomas Krenz and David Vandeleer. We're talking about an exhibit at the Guggenheim called Frank Lloyd Wright, From Within Outward. There's also a gorgeous catalog. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Thomas Krenz, the former director of the Guggenheim Museum, now senior advisor of international affairs for the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation, and David Vandeleer, the Guggenheim's assistant curator for architecture and design. They are the co-curators of an exhibit called Frank Lloyd Wright, From Within Outward. And how long does this show run?
The show is up until August 23rd, and then we're traveling to Bilbao, and it's up there from October to, I think, early February.
Mm-hmm. And we have a slideshow of some of Wright's designs on our website at wnyc.org. Of course, people can also go to the Guggenheim and see what you've put up there. When I was talking about some of those designs that were never realized, the Arizona State Capitol, the Pittsburgh Point Park Civic Center, the Mile High Office Tower in Chicago, the St. Mark's and the Bowery Towers right here in New York, were they all commissions, or did he do some of them on spec? And the ones that weren't built, was it because clients didn't like them, or because they were too expensive or difficult to build?
Well, you know, there's a variety. Probably an answer to that question is all of them. I mean, you just pointed out, or David pointed out, that an unusually large number of Wright buildings were built. I would have guessed that these days, even for star architects like Rem Koolhaas or Frank Gehry, the number is far less. And you could look at situations even here in New York. The Brooklyn Yards, Atlantic Yards project had been developing for 3 or 4 years. Mainly the economy affects the ability for developers to fund projects. So
you would hope to do a Frank Gehry Museum down in Lower Manhattan.
That's right. And you could make the argument that 9/11 intervened on that project because the timing was somewhat coterminous with that. So it's been our experience as we've looked at projects at the Guggenheim in different locations around the world that it is often local conditions. I mean, the economy, politics, and things like that that change it. And of course, developers usually have high aspirations, and they start out with a budget, and the architects design sometimes beyond the budget. The architects get excited about the project. You see those ideas evolve, but that it's really a very, very difficult process to bring architecture to birth, so to speak. And in that regard, Wright had a stunning track record.
But it also looks like some of these buildings must have been very difficult to construct.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that would have scared some people off.
Well, even the Guggenheim in New York was a difficult building, as we've seen. It had a budget at the time in the 1950s, 1952, 53, of about $5 million, which doesn't seem very much these days. And Wright started out with this notion of the spiral and making it a continuous pour, which also, even after construction began, proved to be infeasible. So they had to then do it in sections. And then once the building was, the concrete of the building was poured, the surface, the skin that was provided or placed over the top of it, didn't quite hide the joints as Wright would have originally imagined.
This is reinforced concrete, which is rare in New York because we usually build with a steel skeleton and then
Right. And what we found, I mean, this exhibition also coincides with a four-year renovation of the Guggenheim, which was in large part a structural renovation. And what we found in the analysis of the building that began about 4 or 5 years ago was that many of the construction technologies, which may have been appropriate for the time, probably would not satisfy code, so current code. So the changes, it was a combination of a landmarks preservation issue with much debate. In other words, was the original concept Wright's concept, or what happened? And particularly in the surface and the skin. And I think that we work very closely with Landmarks for the entire project to come to an accommodation of what you might say the best thinking reflected about Wright's work.
And you did restore the fountain that he had wanted.
Well, the fountain, I think, was the almost the easiest part. I mean, we've always, in the time that I've been at the Guggenheim, the fountain has always been there, whether we've covered it for some exhibitions or not, or opened it. But the real issue was the exterior surface of the building and the reinforcement, the structural reinforcement. I mean, we like to say now that the building is good for at least another 100 years.
Although from the start there were people who objected to it. He died 6 months before it was finished, and we see in the show several different versions of his design for it, including some that show the building as red or orange.
Right.
He wanted it to be some kind of a cream color, but from the start that was ignored as well.
Well, actually, there were lots of versions. One of his favorite colors was called Cherokee Red, and there was a notion that
to put paintings on top of Cherokee Red.
Pardon?
Was that for the outside or the interior as well?
It was for the outside. It was for the outside.
Oh, that would have been a bright red snail type building.
But in the drawing, it turned out to be almost a pink. I mean, maybe that faded somewhat over time. So he was experimenting like artists do with various ideas. And there was right up until the final stages of the restoration. I remember the very last presentation that I made to the Landmarks Commission was about this issue of color. Was it evidentiary that Wright had intended a certain color cream, but by the time the building was finished and he had been dead for 6 months, that another color had come in place, and that over years it had gradually gotten lighter as the building was repainted a number of times. And so in the public mind, it was probably lighter than Wright might have imagined, but that at what point do you repaint the painting, so to speak?
Well, also, this is the building we know.
That's right.
And if you suddenly paint it as something to restore it to its original, which we've never had, that would be odd, wouldn't it?
It would. I think that's where we came to this accommodation, and it was the topic of a spirited discussion with Landmarks in a very friendly way, because what we were trying to do, and I think very successful at, was making a partnership with the Landmarks Preservation Commission for the restoration of what arguably is one of New York City's greatest buildings.
Well, David, you've worked as an architect.
I'm not an architect.
Oh.
I would make the worst architect, I think.
But you say you worked in architecture offices. And almost all buildings are compromises, aren't they?
Often they are. You need to work with your client, of course. And I think in the case of the Guggenheim, the focus of the show is really on these spaces that you get on the inside. And a good story, I think, is the years leading up to the original opening of the Guggenheim in 1959. There were so many nicknames for the building, like the washing machine, the Huskross bun, and all of those things.
Well, it kind of looks like the Gordon Strong Automotive Objective and Planetarium, which he also designed not long before that, isn't it?
Well, what you see if you come to the show is that there is like several projects leading up to the Guggenheim. So he's developing this language over a few years, over a few decades. Mm-hmm. And actually, with the Gordon Strong project, he says when a project is killed by the client, Gordon Strong, he writes him a letter and says, like, oh, well, I can never look a snail in the eye again, which is, of course, beautiful. And, yeah.
So, but he was thinking in terms of the ramp form. In that case, it would have been automobiles driving up a ramp.
Well, at the Gordon Strong Auditorium it was, and that's also been the subject of various cartoons in one format or another in The New Yorker, including skateboards going down the ramp. So his ability, it's difficult to since some of these things are almost intuitive and emotional, it's difficult to say when a particular concept exists.
I wonder what happens when things are built much later, because one of his designs, the Monona Terrace Civic Center in Madison, Wisconsin, was built only a few years ago, long after he died. I wonder if there are any thoughts about building some of these other ones, because there's still some extraordinary buildings that he conceived.
Well, I think it's always difficult to build a building without the architects being there, but yeah.
And one of the things that he had wanted that was ignored from the start was to have the paintings exhibited on the ramp lean backward, is the way you'd see them on an easel. Of course, mm-hmm. most artists don't paint that way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they mm-hmm. usually paint straight up. But the museum from the start just ignored that.
Well, if you really there's two comments you could make about that. I think, first of all, the current installation, I think, is for me a kind of apotheosis of 20 years at the Guggenheim, because it's a very simple and spare installation. And by and large, it does just what you suggested, that the drawings are in these almost like drawing board, angled drawing boards that allow them to be taken out of their plastic sleeves, not framed, studied, but not horizontal either. And I think that that reference to Wright's certain drawings that existed of Wright's installation style was a very appropriate part of the exhibition. But I also can say that when I first came to the Guggenheim, and pretty much consistently through the entire 2 decades I was there, there almost seems to be an automatic reaction on the part of critics to say, well, this is a terrible space to show art because the walls are angled and the floor slopes downward. But I have to say that after organizing and presenting more than 150 exhibitions at the Guggenheim, I think it's one of the most spectacular spaces imaginable.
Well, I think today most people love the museum. They have learned to love it and right. recognize what it has to offer. But you must have gone through all sorts of changes. You were there over 20 years, right? And there must have been some curators who said, Tom, what are we going to do?
Well, I think one of the strategies that we adopted early on in terms of presentation was to, just as we did for this exhibition, was we organized teams. I mean, it's not just about a curator making all the decisions. And in those teams, we would often invite a prominent architect to interpret the building and to intermediate between the building itself and the subject. So we've had Frank Gehry and Jean Nouvel and Zaha Hadid and Arata Isuzaki, Hani Rashid, any number of architects who have worked with the building and transformed it dramatically.
Well, in developing other Guggenheims, like the one in Bilbao or the one that's projected for Abu Dhabi, did you draw upon your experiences with this building?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I think that one of the incredible, extraordinary things about the Guggenheim is the concept of the atrium. That is, it becomes, as Wright sort of intended, an omphalos, the center of the museum, and that it's a place that you always orient yourself to. In this case, the spiral goes up around the atrium. In Bilbao, there also is an atrium that's much bigger. The gallery, sets of galleries go off the atrium, but you always come back to the atrium as an orienting point, and Abu Dhabi has some of the same features.
In the old days, an exhibit of this sort would have a couple of little notices on the wall explaining what we were seeing. Now we have computers to tell us so much more. And there's also a documentary film about the museum being shown in conjunction with the exhibit.
Right. We made a documentary about what happened over the last 50 years and what we're doing at the moment. It's actually quite interesting. It's being shown downstairs in the media theater.
And are there computer explanations as well?
Yeah. In addition to the models, we built animations with two schools, MATC, which is the Medicine Area Technical College, and the GSD, the Harvard Graduate School of Design. And it was very important for us to do that because, one, you get people to understand spaces that they might not get from the drawings. And two, it was very important to do an educational project. We worked with these students for months and months. We always did pin-ups on Friday afternoon over the phone with the people in Taliesin on the phone in Arizona, me in New York, and then the students in Cambridge or in Madison. And it was very exciting to do that because I think the students learned a lot from it, and right is not always apparent in the school system anymore. So it felt like a good project.
We've been getting comments from our listeners. One points out that artists have used the building as a space for installation where they can play off the form. But a caller asked, why have you had some exhibits start at the bottom and work up? Wasn't it originally supposed to be from the top down?
Well, in one aspect, there's a very simple explanation for that, is that the building gets bigger the further up you go because it's, in fact, an inverted ziggurat. So the spaces on the top are quite tall and deep, and the spaces on the bottom are smaller and narrower. And as it happens for most artists,
they start small and get larger.
So there's a logic that kind of that almost invariably asserts itself if you're dealing with contemporary artists.
You were the director for 20 years,
right?
Do you miss it at all?
Well, stepping down was probably most influenced by doing the project in Abu Dhabi. And Bilbao happened at a time right at the beginning of my tenure. And while it was an extraordinary learning experience, Abu Dhabi in many ways for me is the apotheosis of art museums. I mean, it will have so many features that go significantly beyond Bilbao that...
Because you learn from Bilbao.
What you learn from Bilbao. So, and also what you learn from, you might say, the field. I mean, what's happened over the last 20 years includes the Tate Modern. I mean, number of museums that have been built around the world, Dia Beacon, factories. Well, what we're trying to do in Abu Dhabi is bring all of this together in one extraordinary statement. And the sheer scale of the project in Abu Dhabi is something that just demands a kind of focus, which is completely absorbing. So I'm quite content at doing what I'm doing.
And Richard Serra keeps on making bigger and bigger sculptures. You're going to have to build bigger museums just to accommodate
them. Exactly right.
This exhibit, Frank Lloyd Wright, From Within Outward, is at the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum. Now through August 23rd, there's a gorgeous catalog, which is published by Skira Rizzoli as well. And as I said earlier, you can see some of the work on a slideshow that we have on our website at wnyc.org. My great thanks to Thomas Krenz, the former director of the Guggenheim, now senior advisor of international affairs for the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation, and David van der Leer, who is the assistant curator of architecture and design at the Guggenheim. They are co-curators of this exhibit. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.